The Coigig Pod on Off the Ball.
And then we had Eileen, who we kind of picked because we thought, you know, knows Irish football inside out, and then that'll do the job. And those kind of things aren't really what we need. We need a really, really good, strong coach.
Subscribe to the Coigig Pod on the Off the Ball app now.
Yeah, you just had to be there.
You know, yeah, you had to be there.
And it was just great to say, like, all right, I was there for that. You know what I mean?
You had to be there.
I wish I wasn't there.
You had to be there.
Right, we have a very special episode of You Had To Be There to celebrate Dr. Strangelove being on from the 5th to the 22nd of February in the Borgosh Energy Theatre. We are delighted to say we have Armando Iannucci with us in studio. How the hell are you?
I'm very good, thank you very much. Very good. Eager to talk all things sport.
Great.
I've just explained that I'm the least sports. I think this would be down as an unusual signing, I think you'd call this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is you getting out of your comfort zone.
I'm hoping to make it you getting out of your comfort zone.
Great. I'm looking forward to that.
You know, when managers sign someone and he goes, what's he thinking? And other people are going, no, it's clever.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but it's a donkey. He signed an actual live donkey. No. This will work. Just you. And then halfway through the season, it was going, I mean, it is a donkey.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not doing very well. And, you know, we need to get rid of.
Think of the shirt sales.
The donkey, and the, so anyway.
But when we ask, we've been doing this series for about 2 years. To be there. And when we ask guests beforehand, you know, they email us with a detailed list of the exact player and when where they were.
Yeah,
and you've come in with, I presume, where you're staying in the hotel, handwritten scroll. But it's a sign of a maverick, isn't it?
It's a sign of a maverick. I've got a handwritten thing yet that I can't read. My own writing, I can't read. It's just deteriorated because of. Let's just blame the internet. Why not?
Well, I was going to say, either that or you've actually got a team of minions who have written this for you and come up with ideas. You've got a writer's room offset, and you're like, oh, give me something for this.
What's a committee has come up with my great sporting moments. Rather like politicians when they do like Desert Island Discs.
Yeah. What do the hipsters say?
They have, you know, their team are all telling them, Keir Starmer, you know, what's your favourite book? And Tony Blair came up with like Ivanhoe as his favourite book. Ivanhoe? Nobody's read Ivanhoe. I don't think Walter Scott had read Ivanhoe. Where did that come from?
Did David Cameron panic himself into picking a football team when he was out?
Yeah,
he went to Aston Villa.
Well,
or Burnley, was it?
No, he said West Bromwich when he was an Aston Villa supporter. I don't know what that's about either, you know.
I thought he was following Alistair Campbell into Burnley or something, but I think he just panicked into saying a team and then he had to stick with it.
Yeah.
He had to go to their games.
Yes. Partick Thistle is my team. No, it's not. You were saying?
Well, I was going to ask, before we get into the sport, can we talk a bit about Dr. Strangelove, speaking of out of comfort zones? Because everybody has an expectation of what Strangelove is going to be. Maybe they don't, actually. Maybe that's an interesting term.
You don't need to know the film at all.
Right.
You don't need to know anything about the film. It's all there in front of you.
Why did you pick it?
I was asked.
Right.
As in, I mean, it's one of the greatest films, comic films of all time. It's set in the Cold War in the 1960s. America and Russia, nuclear weapons pointing at each other. Peter Sellers in the film plays three parts. He plays the American president. He plays an English RAF officer trying to stop a mad American general from starting a war. An American general who's obsessed with fluoridization of America's water. And just as we have Robert Kennedy Jr. At the Senate hearings talking about the fluoridization of America's water. And he also plays Dr. Strangelove, who is this maverick German scientist. This is the 1960s, who had worked in Germany in the 40s on various technological programs, and is now working with NASA, or as he pronounces it, NATSA. And Steve is playing those Peter Sellers parts, but also a fourth part, the pilot of a B-52 bomber flying over Russia. And we have a B-52 bomber on stage.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes, among other things. And somehow Steve has to play those four parts simultaneously.
So who comes to you and says, get involved?
So it was the Kubrick family. They've never done a Stanley Kubrick adaptation before. It's the first time it's been adapted for stage, any of his projects. They were persuaded to do it, and they approached myself and John Foley, Sean Foley, the director. And I think they approached me because I'd just done things like The Death of Stalin, which is very Cold War-esque. I'd done Veep in the US about the White House and so on. So they madly thought I might be the right fit. And I'm so glad when they asked me and I said yes instantly.
I was going to say, yeah.
It was a secret for a while and we were quietly getting on with it. But then when it was announced, there was so much kind of international, oh, what's this going to be like? I'm so glad we'd written it by then.
Right, because the pressure was off in a way.
Yeah.
And the decision to work with Steve Coogan, obviously a lifetime collaborator, was that obvious from...
I mean, you know, you need to have someone who's of the same quality and calibre of Peter Sellers, who can carry off in front of a live audience all these different characters. He's a huge Kubrick fan as well. It just seemed like, you know, I can't imagine anyone else, you know. Mm. And it's a sort of thing I think he felt he should do. And it's been a while since he's done, you know, he's obviously as Partridge, he's done live shows, but he's never done a play. And this is, you know, it's quite a tour de force. We've just finished 4 months in London, sellout shows all the way, and he's amazing. So it's quite a feat.
He's probably, like Steve Coogan, probably is the closest modern version of Peter Sellers, isn't he? Mm. And didn't he auditioned to play him?
I think
20
he did.
Years
yes,
ago and just missed out.
I can't remember who got it in the end, but he wanted to play Peter Sellers and was turned out. So this is his revenge.
And he's going one better.
He's going one better than Sellers. Sellers did three.
Yeah.
And of course, Sellers could film one character 1 week and another week. You know, Steve's got to do them all. And so there's lots of very quick changes going on backstage.
Why do you love Steve so much?
Love? Does love come into... Yes. He is extraordinary. I remember when we started... we started on the radio and I did this radio kind of news show. And I said to Steve, who was in the cast, we need a sports reporter. Can you do like a sports reporter voice? Not an impression of anyone specific, but a kind of amalgam. And when... And I, you know, obviously, he does Alan Partridge better than me. But when he suddenly started doing this, you know, this was coming. Instantly, we knew. And instantly, somebody said, he's Alan. And someone else said, and he's a Partridge. I mean, it was instant. It was like, you know, watching a horse give birth to a foal, who then just immediately stands up fully formed and starts walking. I mean, Alan fell on the floor fully formed with a microphone in his hand. And he started talking. And we kind of instantly knew he had all these aspirations to be treated seriously. He was a proper journalist. All the news reporters are looking down on him because all he talks about is sport and groin injuries and whatever. But he wants a show on the telly and he wants to be light entertainment and he wants to, you know, all of that. But, but the thing about Steve, when we did start doing the telly stuff, you know, and if you're producing or you're directing, you're in the edit and you're watching the same takes or similar lines again and again and again month after, it's still making you laugh. If you're still laughing, if you're still drawn towards him, it's a very, very special gift he has that he can occupy the moment so comedically and memorably, which he does, especially in his Dr. Strangelove, who has all these technologically assisted limbs that fly off in various kind of unprovoked Nazi gestures and whatever. It's a very special, you know, he makes me laugh. And you know, he still does.
What type of relationship do you have with him when you're collaborating? Is it tension or...?
Yeah, it's not... No, it's not tension. I think he will pace around and he will, like, when we're doing Partridge, he will be Alan. So he's like sitting with Alan Partridge 12 hours a day. I mean, it does... It drove me mad. I mean... And I said to Steve, it's not you, it's Alan Potter. Because he stays in character and you lob ideas and Steve will improv and then you might finish a sentence and suggest a new thing and whatever. And it really is like that. So,
Are you writing that down? Are you recording those sessions?
Yes, yeah. I'm
not in your handwriting, obviously, but yeah.
There is a document that's like 150 pages long of all the bilge Alan has talked that has yet not been used, you know, over the years. You know, it's just the great reams. Because the thing about Alan being a sports commentator, especially as a radio one, you know, as he said, dead air is a crime. He has to keep talking. And Steve actually said it helped that he didn't know much about sport,
yeah,
improvising as Alan, commentating and stuff, because it just meant he had to just keep going with any old nonsense. There's the boats, the two boats, the Oxford boat, the Cambridge boat. Where are the others? The others have been left behind, you know, just any old nonsense. You know, you know, you mustn't say, you mustn't sound too knowledgeable, you know. So that was a kind of great blessing, actually.
There's a scene in I'm Alan Partridge where, yeah, the joke stops becoming funny with 10 seconds to go to the top of the hour, but he has to laugh to the top of the hour because, oh, yeah, he has nothing else to say. Yes. Before he says news.
The news. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. All those little things. But I started off in radio. It wasn't local radio. It was national. I mean, it was Radio, oh, yeah, Scotland. So it was national radio. But all those kind of, you just get a feel for those, the inner workings of how a show happens, especially a live one.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all great stuff to use.
Can I ask one more question about, yeah, Strangelove? How are you going to do it on stage when more than one character is in a scene at once?
We haven't thought about it. We're still working. No, it's you must come and see. Because we've had to work out ways in which we can make the switch without anyone being aware of it.
Mm.
And that was one of the first things we looked at. So over a year ago, first thing we looked was that, was when one character finishes, another character starts. How do we get, in the least amount of time, the switch? But I don't want to go too much into it. But it is all real. It's all happening live on stage. There are no holograms. And there's a little bit of video footage at the start, but that's really to as a part of the warm-up. It's all happening live. So it's physically Steve being in four places across the show. Yeah.
You mentioned the radio and it being a great grounding and really useful for the Partridge stuff, but all, yeah, the rest of the bits that happen afterwards, do you see a pattern when you look back in your career from that bit where you're in BBC Radio Scotland, mm-hmm, to the Kubrick family reaching out to, hey, you're the right guy for this?
It's unintentional. I mean, there was never a kind of back of the envelope plan as to what I wanted to do. I just wanted to make funny stuff. And I suppose, you know, starting in radio, and you always write about what you know, and I knew radio, so the early stuff was a kind of parody of radio, not just sport but news. But that was just a way of allowing us to tell stupid stories, really. The more authentic it sounded, weirdly, the funnier. You know, the Bank of England has lost the pound. It's like, but as you go, the Bank of England has lost the pound. It's not as funny as the kind of,
yeah,
you know, absolute po-faced, yeah, delivery, you know. And also working with people who were sports reporters or who were news broadcasters, because I could then use them to say my words, you know, because they knew the delivery. But there was no plan. And then I suppose once you talk about news and news parody, you then start looking at the news.
Well,
much is news, what you see, how much is it manipulated, and how much is it objective. When we were doing On the Hour for television, the day-to-day, we actually went on a news course just to get the mechanics of it. And I realised how it was all driven by pictures, by visuals. You know, we were told, you've got 2 hours to put together a report on this war. Here's the unedited footage. Here are the 4 points you need to make. But as time was running out and I realised, I've got pictures for three of the points, but not the fourth one. Just under pressure, I just ditched the fourth point. And that made me realise, actually, it's all driven by the visuals. And then it opens up that whole question of, and therefore it's not, no one news programme is completely objective. Mm. You know, there is an editor there saying,
deciding
this is going to be the headline, this is going to be number two, and this is going to be the points we're making, and this is like, let's not say that, but let's say that.
And does that change your sense of what you're doing? So you wanted to tell funny stories.
But then, you know, you get close to the information and therefore you get close to, in my case, politics, I suppose.
Yeah.
For me, the great kind of impulse was the Iraq war, the invasion, the UK, Blair and Bush and the invasion of Iraq. And everyone saying, but this is mad. Why are you doing that? And the fact, you know, that in the UK, a prime minister could make that happen despite all the opposition around. So then made me think, how does that work? How does the constitution or a lack of one work where something can be done like that and there are no checks and balances, which then made me look closer at the subject of politics, which then led to the thick of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, and then I suppose over the real years, you're thinking, you know, what is it interest? Well, I'm interested in power and influence. Where is it? Who's exercising power? It's not necessarily the politicians. It might be
the
media, the press, yeah. the and now the information, you know, oligarchs. Yes, yeah.
Am I right in saying that about 100 odd days into Donald Trump's first term, you said you wouldn't make the thick of it then? And then I'm wondering now, you know, approaching 100 days into his second term, has that changed?
It would be a very different thick of it. I mean, Malcolm Tucker wouldn't survive now. He'd be done for bullying. You know, he'd have to go on all sorts of courses to kind of rein his language in. But it's more, I suppose, you know, the thick of it and Veep, actually, the HBO show, were about a time when it was all about politicians bending the rules, maybe occasionally breaking the rules, but then worrying that they might be found out. But the thing with Trump and everything since is they want you to know that they've broken the rules or that they've ignored the rules. You know, it's all about there are no rules. I can do what I like now. You know, he launched his first campaign saying, you know, I can shoot a guy in the face in the middle of Fifth Avenue and people will still vote for me, you know. And here he is, a convicted felon in the White House. So he's right. So I would find it hard to go back to that model of it's all about people quietly, subtly bending. You know, that's gone. That's a golden era. That's when it was great.
Yeah, which we didn't realize at the time.
Yeah.
But I think there's a straight line between that war in Iraq and where we are now and that kind of unspooling of a sense of responsibility and a connection between.
I mean, when that happened, I remember someone, a leader in the Middle East saying, you do this and you will unleash the gates of hell. And I think he was right. I mean, it's still the consequences of it are still with us. The whole uprooting of countries, the whole breakdown of order, that sense that it's now a valid thing to do to just invade another country under no pretext and then try and come up with the evidence afterwards. You know, Blair afterwards tried to explain that there were no weapons of mass destruction. The whole point was to go into Baghdad because Saddam Hussein had these weapons of mass destruction. Here's all the evidence showing it. Turned out the evidence was supplied by some weird drug addict in Germany who was told he would get paid if he supplied the Americans with the evidence. So just thought, great. But afterwards, Blair tried to explain it, saying, you know, he believed at the time it was the right thing to do. And he said, knowledge isn't the same as facts. I only know what I believe. And I thought, that's the opposite of what people have done for the last 2,000 years, which is get the facts first and then draw your conclusion. You're now admitting that you start with your conclusion and then try and find. I only know what I believe. Start with a believe and then find the stuff you know to back up that belief.
Yeah, it's the opposite of the Enlightenment. It's the return to faith-based politics.
It's faith-based politics, yes. It's that, and once that gets out of control, you get that situation that you have in America, which is like any conspiracy, any, you know, if you believe it, it's valid, you know.
Yeah, which is what, you know, when we in the West, broad term, were looking down on the non democracies of other parts of the world.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they're fundamentalists who are guided by theology instead of intelligence, like us.
Whereas we now have an American president who literally said he was saved by God for a purpose, you know. Therefore, that's the era we're in. And who respects those leaders who have autocratic and even faith-based.
Is best mates with many of them.
Exactly.
Some of my best friends are autocrats.
Yeah.
So if you were 20 years, 30 years younger, starting out now doing satire, how the hell would you do it?
I think you look at the language, I'm doing a podcast every week called Strong Message Here, which looks at that week's political language and how words are misused or used or used for different reasons and so on. And I suppose you look at that, you know, get away from doing the impressions of, it's always nice to see a really good Trump impression, of course, or I don't know if anyone does a good Keir Starmer impression, but that only takes you a certain way. It's I think people genuinely want to know, what is the thinking? What do they mean by that? Because a lot of the frustration in politics, I think, is people feel they're not, what's happening there on our screens is different from what we thought or wanted or asked for or feel the need for. It's like in the UK, we can't mention Brexit, even though the public would love to undo Brexit. But we can't mention it. It'll just, no, we can't. That's done, you know.
It's so mad.
It's mad.
We're sitting here watching it.
I know.
What happened? Was there something in the water? I mean,
it's weird. And so we go through these weird things going, okay, we're free now to make our own trade agreements. What we need to do now is reach out, think creatively. What's a good trading block that we should have a much closer relationship? Well, how about this one over here? It's the nearest one. It's this massive bit of mainland called Europe. And if only there was some way of getting into some kind of trade agreement where maybe, I don't know, there's frictionless movement between goods and perhaps even people. Who knows? I mean, we should certainly be thinking about it. You know, that's where we are now.
It's radical, that.
Yeah, like, radical, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
If you were starting off now as well, like, could you envision yourself uploading on TikTok and Instagram as well, and going down that route of comedy? Because, like, that's kind of feels like the new generation is coming from necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I started off doing, and this was before everything was on tape, and, you know, we physically had to cut the tape to do edits and stuff. But I did, you know, mixes and remixes and take political speeches and recut them. And then I did that visually on a show called The Friday Night Armistice. But again, it was before internet and YouTube and, you know, it was there. So I think I probably would.
That
idea of taking bits of reality and re-editing them to in a comic way, I think would have be very much, because that's really how I started anyway.
Can I ask you a really unfair question?
Yeah, go on. What is God?
That's a very good question. We'll finish with that one. What has been your peak so far?
My peak? I don't know. I mean, it's like saying, what's my favourite? I don't know. Yeah. I can't tell. Do you know what I mean? Because whenever you start a new thing, I remember being asked, actually, just doing a talk at a school, and they always say the kids come up with the best questions. And the first question I got was a boy who said, when you start a new project, how do you overcome your fear of failure? And I thought, my God, I've never been asked. I've got to think about this one. And I think it's, you have to forget everything you've done before, as in you have to go into this project as if it's your first, as in go in with all that enthusiasm and energy and that desire to make it as good as possible.
Well, that's why you're doing something mad and like having the same actor play four roles and the same, with a B-52 on the stage.
Exactly, yeah. It's really economic, you know, it makes economic sense to have one person play four, you know. but it's that, really. So in terms of, I also feel once you've made something, it's kind of not yours anymore. It's whoever's watching.
I hear a lot of people say that, actually, in the entertainment
you've
industry.
You've got to just let it go. Don't go back. I don't go back and rewatch. I just think, and however people react to it, that's fine. You know, if people don't like it, as long as you feel you've done what you wanted to do and you're happy with it, it's really, you can't dictate what the public perception of it is. And you know, different people say to be different things, that they, you know, they like Alan Partridge staying at the Travel Tavern, they like The Death of Stalin, or you know, that I like doing the Amanda Unity shows on Channel 4. A lot of sort of personal thought went into that. I don't know. I can't tell.
I know we need to get to your list, but when you if you flick
my
by
eligible list,
an episode of Partridge or Veep or a thick of it, do you stop and watch it?
Occasionally, I tell you what, when you're flicking through and on, you know, UK Gold or something, like maybe a Partridge comes up and it's long enough for you to have genuinely forgotten what the next line is. So it's I'm kind of watching it as a first time viewer and then, you know, and then I laugh, but occasionally I go, yeah, this scene's gone on a bit too long now. You know, you start, somebody has done a kind of mastermind subject on one contestant did Alan Partridge, another contestant did, I think, the Day Today. And I thought, I'll play them like live as it's on the telly. I'll see if they got more than me. I mean, you just forget, you know, I forget all the kind of little, you know, what was a branch of clubs, country clubs that Alan was a member of. I can't remember. It was, apparently it was Choristers. Was the name.
Of course.
I can't remember.
Someone asked you in another talk, what's your favourite scene ever that you're involved in? And it was, you've never seen Alan Partridge happier than when he's walking down a motorway with a plastic bag of...
windscreen water fluid, singing the theme to Goldfinger, the song from Goldfinger, just as cars are kind of shooting past.
He does a little skip.
That's him at his happiest, I think. Yeah. He's internally, I think he's... You know, he's full of worries and concerns, but I think he's fundamentally happy. If he knew what other people thought of him, I think he would crumble. So I think he has a thicker skin than people might suspect.
It's been a ridiculous career when you think about it. The success of Veep, there are episodes of Veep which feel like pure TV perfection, but then you look at the other list of people you've worked with, Chris Morris, mm-hmm. Stuart Lee, mm-hmm. they're all people who have a style or an aesthetic, but also a political viewpoint. That's clearly not a coincidence that you've all coalesced over a period of time.
Yeah, we've been very lucky. And it's not like we've been a troupe.
We weren't
a gang. We sort of came together originally on the Hour and the Day Today. And then we've all gone off and done a kind of individual stuff, but we all still... We had a bit of a day-to-day reunion to come and see Dr. Strangelove with Steve a couple of months back. And, you know, we all check in on each other and help out with each other and look at each other's stuff. But it's not been, we've never been a company or a team, you know, because teams end up splitting up.
Well,
and we've just been a group of individuals who are all friends and all get each other, but all have different, very different styles.
Different styles, but certainly similar outlooks, I would say, in terms of what you're trying to skew with that rest of power.
Jesse Armstrong was on Think of It and Veep, and he did Succession, and Will Smith was on Avenue 5 and Veep, and he did Slow Horses, and you know, we all kind of it's been nice to see that spread, and I don't think any of that would have happened if we were this kind of named group.
Yeah,
actually,
because it gives you the freedom to go off and do stuff. What? How did you all attract each other? What was the...
Oh, heavens. I think I was doing some topical shows on Radio 4 and I was looking for topical writers. And so I had a bit of a writing room in which all these guys, and Simon Blackwell, who, you know, did Breeders and I did David Copperfield with. And I just took a note of the funny ones.
That's kind of magical,
isn't it? And then when we started doing The Thick of It, I asked them to get involved, really. Yeah. Actually, Jesse Armstrong, a lot of the names, I think of it, Jesse Armstrong used to play five-a-side, and it was just the names of everyone in his team. So there was a Malcolm Tucker and an Ollie Witt and a Terry Coverley. God knows what they make of it now, but...
No royalties for them anyway.
No royalties.
All right. What the hell does this say?
So you asked me for like my four greatest sporting moments. Now. Yeah. I mean, I'm terrible. It's not that I dislike sport. I like watching sport. I think I tell myself I just must have missed the lessons when they, you know, explain to you how you kick a football or how you do the crawl in a swimming pool. I remember, I haven't written this down, but I remember swimming. You know, I thought swimming for me was always, it was a bit of an effort. You know, I could swim, but I felt it was a bit of an effort, all the getting changed and then spluttering about and not quite enough. So I thought when I was about 30, I saw in the local swimming baths, you know, improvers' lessons. I thought, I'll go to those. And it was great. And I learned a lot. And I love swimming. But it was mostly people who weren't used to being terrible, now suddenly being very terrible, wearing very little on, being told what to do by an 18-year-old. And there was one lesson when she was trying to explain the crawl. And there was one guy, quite a big chap, in his sort of 40s. And he was struggling and she was trying to encourage him. And he just shouted, aerodynamically, this isn't possible. And she said, but this is the crawl. People are swimming this for for thousands of years. And he just went, nope. And he got out and left and never came back. And I think there's someone who's, maybe he ran a small business or something.
Yeah,
and he was so used to just asking for people to do stuff. The idea of him looking awful.
I don't think that was about her.
Yeah. So I kind of enjoy watching sport. And I grew up with like two sports mad brothers and, you know, my brother who I shared a room with when I was, you know, in my early teens and, you know, 10, 12 and early teens, you know, he was a mad Liverpool and Celtic fan. Right. So, you know, I could tell you all about the Liverpool teams from the 1970s, you know.
They're on your wall.
The Steve Highway and
oh, yeah.
Toshack era, you know, all that. I could tell you about that. I sort of acquired that familiarity with it, but maybe in a kind of, but I was very bookish. And so maybe in a kind of slightly rebellious way, I went down the way of classical music and Charles Dickens novels. but I am fascinated by it. I really like watching sports documentaries, actually. There's something about the drama of it. And I love, you know, the big, I could quite happily watch football matches if they're a big, you know, the World Cup. So, you know, being Scottish, I will be Scottish and Italian, you know, I've got the best of both.
That is pretty good. Yeah. You know?
But I can never really watch Scotland since Argentina, whatever it was, 78.
Yeah.
It was traumatic. And it was very late on. And, you know, the matches were on at 11 o'clock at night. And it was it Iran and then Peru or something? And then they had to beat Brazil. No, Holland. They had to beat Holland by 3 goals and nearly did it. But it was so traumatic that I have never watched a Scotland game ever since.
Really?
I find it too
that's
too
the,
stressful.
That's the Archie Gemmill game, is it?
That's right. Where he runs and got that, you know, one of the greatest goals of all time.
Yeah.
But feature on it in World Cup Italia 90, actually. They block
but
it
I
out.
Did want to mention, so it's not quite technically watching a match live, but I have a special memory of the 82 World Cup in Barcelona, wasn't it? Yes. Because my father died at a young age. He was 56 that summer. And so I would have been about 16 and my brothers were, you know, 20 and 24. And just watching the Brazil-Italy game was just one of the most extraordinary matches I've ever watched. You know, the lead just backwards and forwards. And then Italy going on to win the World Cup that summer. And it was such a kind of, for my brothers especially, it was such a kind of good moment after the kind of, I think my dad passed away in like June. So it was very soon. And Glasgow, all the Italians in Glasgow driving around George Square with flags and stuff like that. So that was...
Your mum and dad were obviously both Italian.
So my mum was born in Glasgow, but her parents were Italian. Okay. So both sides of the family.
Why did they end up in Glasgow?
Good question. So my mother's side came over after the First World War. My dad came over. He fought in the partisans against the fascists as a teenager, really. And after the Second World War, just felt he had to go somewhere else. Glasgow at the time was a big port, shipbuilding. There were jobs there. Right. People travelled by ship then rather than flying. His boat was due to go on to New York, but it docked at Glasgow. He got off, fell in love and settled, and the rest is history. And there are large Italian communities there. I mean, it's food, really. It's like, you know, Italians bringing food to Scotland in the 1920s.
I mean, a blast of colour.
That was a popular move.
Yeah, I'm sure.
A popular move. And
he was politically inclined, so there was obviously politics in the house growing up.
Yeah, and it's a weird one. I mean, people will talk about how, you know, people who went through that don't discuss it. And he didn't really. The odd little story emerged. But I remember when the World at War was on and it came to the episode about the concentration camps, and he actually got up and left the room and he said, I can't watch this, but you must.
Right.
Mm. And that was it, you know. And this is a general thing. You talk to anyone who had parents or grandparents who had experienced awful things at that time. They didn't talk about it, but they kind of wanted people to know what happened.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. He was a great believer in education. Education and knowledge was his thing. Yeah.
As a 16-year-old, when your dad dies so young, it must have been a feeling of rootlessness.
Well, there is always that thing, you know, we're Italians in Scotland, and I had just got news that I'd won a place at Oxford, so I was then going to be a Scot in England and first to leave Glasgow to go to university and all that kind of... and therefore being at Oxford, which has a kind of image of... I think Brideshead Revisited had come on. So it was all that image of, like, Hooray Henrys and your Boris Johnsons and so on, which is there, but it's also people, you know, like me. It was all very lucky time when everything was paid for, your student grants were paid for. And so it wasn't like I didn't have to have money, as it were.
Yeah.
But you are then surrounded by people who do, but also people who became some of my greatest lifelong friends. Also people who were there because they wanted to learn. You know, that was the thing. I wanted to go somewhere where it wasn't seen as odd,
yeah,
that you wanted to learn and know, and you could have discussions with people about stuff. But yes, like you say, you're that kind of weird at a time in Glasgow when things were very difficult because my father had passed away and there was, his finances weren't the best ordered. Let's say, so it was a bit of a, you know, so there was all that uncertainty and so on. So it took me a while to adjust, yeah.
Did you ever go back to live in Glasgow?
Yeah, I mean, you'd be up there. I mean, the terms at Oxford are quite short. So you're up in, you know, I was up there for half the year in terms of in between terms. And then I did comedy at Oxford and as a result sent a tape off to Radio Scotland who were looking for young presenters. They wanted to change their image. They wanted young. So I presented a music show on Radio Scotland with the likes of Eddie Mayer and so on. And I was allowed to do comedy then. So then I was back in Glasgow, actually, as my first, yeah. Which was great, actually. I loved it. And it was a great training ground for everything after that.
I can make out your second one. It's that's the 2004 Women's
Italy, Wimbledon Brazil.
Final.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what's this?
Serena Williams, Sharapova.
Just to watch it. And I was very lucky working at the BBC and, you know, the BBC obviously running Wimbledon and, they invite various, you know, when they, during the games, when they go, oh, let's see who's in now during the rain delay or something. Let's see, Cliff Richard's here. And next to Cliff Richard is Larry Hagman. And, you know, and so I was invited along and my wife and I went to the tennis. My wife loves watching tennis. And we were at Centre Court and it was a semi-final with Serena Williams and Sharapova. I was next to like Salman Rushdie and Simon Sharma, who was swearing like a docker.
Wow.
All the way. Just wasn't what I expected.
That's a perfect play.
And great match. What I hadn't appreciated, I don't think what you get on the television, is how gladiatorial it is. It's a small...
It is small, isn't it?
Small amount of space. And then the audience all around them, right up, you know, it's really, there's nowhere to hide. Mm. And I found that absolutely fascinating. And obviously, it's an amazing sport to watch, especially live, actually, because, you know, you're not restricted to the angle, the camera. You know, sometimes the angle is like, why are you showing it there?
Yeah.
But actually, the atmosphere is great. And after the big, you know, the semifinals, most people went away, but we thought we've got a ticket. So we stayed till like sundown. And there's some obscure mixed doubles first round match, but I think it's a great game to watch. I think it's so that was fantastic. Yeah, yeah.
Would you go back? Is that the type of thing that you?
I'd love to, but you know, I now can't exercise. I think the BBC and all it's being hounded by the media for the amount of money it pays for
anything
for people to do a job. they've done away with all that kind of like hospitality, this and whatever. So you have to put your name in the ballot and just hope. Do you know? We spent whatever it was 5 or 6 years doing I'm Alan Partridge 2 seasons, not realizing that at the time Sally Phillips' dad used to run Wimbledon. She didn't let that on.
Oh, no way.
What? He was one of the kind of managers of the whole, what? So I could have used that. I could have pulled that favour, but no. Anyway.
Why was there 5 years between those 2 seasons?
I think we just like not overdoing it. Do you know what I mean? Season one of Alan Partridge was such an unexpected success because we did Knowing Me, Knowing You, which was a chat show, and then they said, do you want to do a second series? And we went, no. what happens if he's been taken off air? So why don't we see him not quite at home? He's staying at a hotel equidistant between London and Norwich so he can do his morning show and then zap into London for meetings. We actually stayed at a kind of like a travel lodge equidistant between London and Norwich to see what it was like. It was a kind of very special kind of hell. You know, because we decided we'll stay for 24 hours. So like we'll do dinner, we'll do breakfast, and then we'll stay and we'll do lunch. We didn't last till lunch. We really didn't last. And it had genuinely, there's an episode of I Am My Partridge where it's Valentine's night. And this was prompted by when we were staying at this place. I had a poster up saying, come to our Valentine's night. £50 gets you a candlelit dinner for two. A half bottle of champagne, brackets, not to be taken into the main bar area, close brackets. So even in its sales pitch, it was telling you what you weren't allowed to do. It's like you're not here to enjoy yourselves. Yeah. You're here to have Valentine's dinner. And
get that down,
And the restaurant was called Hobson's Choice because the chef was Hobson. But Hobson's Choice means it could go either way. You know, it could go badly or it could go well. Who knows? You know, and it had, I mean, it was next to an A road, a very busy A road. So cars, just the noise. But it had a cracked helipad circle in its grounds. It had a big concrete circle with the letter H in it, but all cracked, clearly hadn't been used for like 20 years, with moss and stuff growing in the cracks, you know. But which travel lodge has a helipad?
I was going to say, who were the people who were using their helicopter to land at the travel lodge?
I want to copter me in to Linton. It was in Linton, a place. Anyway, how did we get onto this? I can't remember.
Tennis.
Tennis, yeah. Tennis, wow.
Yeah. We're halfway through the list.
Are we?
Yeah.
Oh, we've done 10. Yeah. So, next one, I'm trying to read my writing here, is, well, this is like two. This I'm going to say running for two. There's two here. Because like I said, I wasn't very adept at sport, but it's not my ability. It was just my attitude, which was I could never quite understand why you should do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I didn't have that competitive, you know, it's all about winning. I just thought, well, I'll do it if you want, but I'd rather be doing it. And I was quite a good runner. I knew I was quite a good runner. And I remember the poor kind of, you know, head of sport sort of sitting me down on the field one day and saying, look, I mean, you've got a great technique there. You've got great ability, great natural ability. And I think, you know, if I can work with you, if you can work on it, you know, we can come in, we can do Saturday mornings, we could get you, you know, I think there's some real potential here. And all the way inside my head, I was just going, why on earth would I want to do any of that? That sounds terrible. You know?
And the poor heartbroken guy, teacher.
You know, he could see there was some, oh my God, we've got like a cross country. No, I just went, I didn't want to do that.
You're his one-way ticket out of Palookaville.
I want to watch Tiz Wars on a Saturday morning. I don't want to watch
He's picturing you at the Olympics.
So anyway, cut to, I'm now a dad. And I go to my daughter's, it's the infant's sports day. And it's the infant's, it's the dad's race. And I thought, well, I do run. I did, you know, until my knees gave way. I did enjoy running. I thought, yeah, well, okay, I'll do the dad's race. That's fine. Yeah, don't worry, I'll do the dad's race. And I noticed all the other dads had like really state-of-the-art trainers and running shoes on. And
shorts.
What the hell is this? What's going on here? This is a bit bad. And then anyway, I kind of lined up to do it. And then I looked across and in the dad's line was Linford Christie. who was a dad. And I thought, oh, I see. They all know that Linford Christie's a dad, and they've invested in, this is going to be awful. And to his credit, he ran in front because he could, but towards the end, he dropped back to allow one dad to pass him and win so they could spend the rest of their life saying, I beat Linford Christie. So there's that. But I then want to flip to something I was at. You know, my wife and I very much enjoy watching athletics. And when it was the London Olympics, we did that, you know, it's a bit of a gamble. We'll just go online, see what we can find. And we found a night at the track and field at the Olympics. It was a Saturday. We went there and it turned out to be what became Super Saturday. So we were there for Jess Ennis winning heptathlon, Graham Rutherford winning the long jump, which was done right in front of us, and Mo Farah winning the 10,000 metres. It was amazing. I mean, it was the most intense, sensational, fantastic, magical evening. And for the 10,000 metres, 10,000 metres, I mean, everyone was shouting far too early because it is 10,000, you know? But it kept going and it kept going and you shouted yourself hoarse. By the end, it got so loud that I couldn't hear myself scream. It was that loud. And you were so swept away. And it was just such an emotional moment. So I felt lucky. And it was just luck of the draw that Rachel managed to get this. I think somebody had resold the tickets or something, couldn't make it. We grabbed it, you know, 3 months in advance. We just happened to land like the one of the best nights in British athletics. And it was so amazing that after Mo Farah's win, the announcement then came, we will now have the final of the women's 100 metres. And there was a sense of, and that used to be like...
Yeah, that was the thing, wasn't
the
it?
The thing,
yeah.
You know. So at school, I 1500 was my thing. So I always do take an interest in 1500 metres. So that was a kind of affirmation of my terrible athletics career.
We've just got the wrap-up signal, so we go to your last one.
If you can read what the last one says.
Soup.
That says rowing, right? Oh, well, it was just more rowing. So I did do rowing at school, actually, as an alternative to rugby, because rugby always struck me as insane. And I've never heard a good story from anyone who plays rugby. It's always about how they cannot walk anymore because their knee is somewhere over 50 miles away and they haven't retrieved it. But we were given the option of switching to rowing and athletics, which I did, and I loved rowing, actually. But we would train on a Saturday morning, and what we hadn't told the school was that we were on the Clyde, we would row round the corner. We had an arrangement with the other school in their boathouse. We'd get out at their boathouse, and we'd sit and watch Tiswas. And then about an hour later, we'd cover ourselves in water to look like we'd sweated it. And then we'd row back round. And that was seen by the school as like... But at one tournament, I remember I came off my seat, which is a disaster because everything is so much in time and just get one thing wrong. And we fell behind, but the team in front slowed down a bit and we thought, hang on. And we managed to rewrite the boat and we just, every ounce of energy we put into it, and we won. And I'm told, because I was back at the old school recently, they said, that is still to discuss to this day, that win. So again, weirdly, I have some strange sporting...
No, that's brilliant.
...kind of legendary status somewhere.
And I'm sure occasionally in the writer's room it pops out from Alan Partridge. And it's all there.
Yeah. It's the keys to only know half of what you're talking about.
Well, you've done brilliantly here for this. Thanks for being such a good sport.
Oh, pleasure.
And everybody should buy tickets to go and see Dr. Strangelove in the Borgosh Energy Theatre. It sounds like it's going to be spectacular. Armando Iannucci, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.